The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on March 19, 2006. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I don't know if I have a lot to say this morning, but I thought I'd just say a few things that might give us something to discuss. And maybe we can talk a bit. This past week in the Monday night class on the Heart Sutra, the Diamond Sutra, I recalled a quote by Karen Armstrong, who's a religion scholar, I guess we could say. Has written widely on religion, various religions, and interesting person. And she said that the purpose of religion is to help us get past the ego. That's the purpose of religion, that we get past the ego. Of course, this is very central in Buddhism, I think. And maybe when we hear that, we might nod and think, yeah, you know, that kind of makes sense. Yes, I hope it does to you. But then we forget about that immediately, and we think something like, yeah, that's what I want to do. I want to get past the ego. And we don't see the contradiction in that. I want to get past the ego. So immediately we are engaging our grasping mind. And it takes us a long time, I think, to really settle down and to realize what this teaching and practice is. And I think Karen Armstrong is right, at least in terms of Buddhism, that this practice, this way, is about getting past the ego, or just maybe, I don't know, getting past it, just letting it drop. My own teacher, Katagiri Roshi, used to tell the story that to remember, you know, that the tree of enlightenment, he said, this is a story from India, he said, but the tree of enlightenment grows on the mountain of egolessness. So a tree of enlightenment grows on the mountain of egolessness. So even though we go looking high and low for this tree of enlightenment, we want to eat, you know, eat the fruit of the tree of enlightenment, you become enlightened. People look everywhere, but just the very nature of our seeking, we're just crawling all over the foothills and mountains and valleys of ego. We don't know about that mountain of egolessness. And somewhere in our practice we should begin to recognize when this is coming up. Of course, maybe it's hard to recognize because it's always there. It's just, so how do you find when it's not? Might be difficult. But for this, you know, we can look at our own motives, what's driving us, and then sometimes we forget what it is that we want. What is it that we want? It isn't a thing. It isn't something you can imagine. It isn't something you can get hold of. It isn't something you can acquire. We want to be awake. Well, if we still are wrapped in our ego and say, I want to be awake, well, then we don't understand what this being awake is. It's not for you. It's not for me. It's not for anybody in particular. But there is awakeness. There's awakening. And we can realize that, of course. It isn't anyone in particular who realizes that. But we shouldn't lose sight of this matter. And, you know, there's an interesting quote by Susan B. Anthony, if I recall it right. That's off the top of my head now, so if I didn't get this quite right. But she said something to the effect that she said, I distrust people. She said, I distrust those who know so well what God wants them to do, because I have noticed that it seems to conform to their own desires. This is the problem that we face. even here we take up this practice in this way, we become attached to things. Around here, I don't give us a lot of things, really. Partly because of that reason. It's so easy for us to become attached to that. But anything at all. But certainly the grandiose thing, like wear a robe like this, I don't know. I don't wear it so much now. When I give a talk like this, I do, but usually I don't wear it now. I've seen how often people get caught by that. Or other things, you shave the head, you know. Because Buddhists, you know, they shave the head. Well, some do. But the shaving of the head is non-attachment. That's what that kind of symbolizes. But the very fact that it symbolizes anything makes it a graspable. Oh, yes, I want that non-attachment. There we go again. So to shave the head, not to shave the head, to wear the robe, not to wear the robe. See, all of this is something that's taking place in our minds, and we don't look at that very carefully. We want to do it right. We want to get it. But we want to kind of shape and form religion or a religious practice to suit our own egoistic desires when we're not careful. And we should realize that this gets us involved in ordinary, you know, grasping mind all over again. And we can get caught anywhere along the way. I remember years ago, I was working with a fellow. He was a born-again Christian. And when he found out that I took kindly to the theory of evolution, he would argue with me on some of these points of evolution. How illogical it was, he would say. Evolution is illogical. He didn't find it illogical that God spoke and suddenly there's the earth and all these different things. That we could have a star over Bethlehem and things. He didn't find those things illogical. That Noah could load all the animals and things into the, you know. He didn't find it even illogical that there's two accounts of Noah and the flood in the Bible, or several accounts of creation. But he finds evolution illogical. Of course, it's just a theory. Just a theory. And of course, the way we use that term in our popular exchange, theory is just sort of somebody just tossing off some ideas. But in science, the word theory doesn't mean that at all. And what I learned in talking with this fellow was that the approach that he took toward truth and understanding in his religion, he was applying those same standards to science. He didn't understand that science begins with making an observation. You notice something. And then when you notice something and you think, well, how did that happen? What's going on there? You're curious about it. So what do? Well, you study it for a little while, you look at it, and then you maybe form an idea. It's called a hypothesis. Here's where you spin out some little idea, but it's not just spinning it out because you're just sitting there daydreaming. You're looking at something, and you're thinking about how it might work or happen or whatever. And you form an idea like that. And then you test it, and you test it in all kinds of ways to see if your idea still holds up. Not only do you test it, but you have to lay it out in such a way that other people can come along and do the same thing. They can replicate it. This is not an illogical system, you know. And gradually over time, we begin to find out which hypotheses, which ideas we are holding, seem to be holding up. And gradually we find out those kinds of ideas and things that don't match reality, don't match what we observe. And over a period of time, we start to acquire a lot of different kinds of notions, ideas, understandings, concepts about how nature is working. And they coalesce into larger and larger views and pictures. Until finally we have something that we would call a theory. But by the time we get to a theory, we have something that's really been tested and tested and tested by many different people and replicated over and over again. So it's a pretty endurable method that we have to find truth, to uncover truth. But as I was talking with this young man, this is many years ago, I was a bit younger myself, but I was talking with him, I realized that he thought that scientists just come up with these ideas, just as they have ideas in his religious views, they just have these ideas and then they just kind of promote these ideas. He didn't understand the method by which they arrived at these ideas. How carefully everything was examined and tested. And at the moment you find something wrong, or somebody does, they will publish that, they will show that. And if there's something to it, well, that theory, that hypothesis will be dropped or changed or modified. It's an impeccable method for finding out what our experience is. Buddhism is very close to that way. The scientific method is called an empirical method. In other words, it's based on observation, it's based on experience. The only difference between Buddhism and science, really, basically, I think, is that in Buddhism we don't form a hypothesis. We don't form an idea about what is going on here. We just live with the direct observation of what is taking place. And the reason for that is because it is so easy for us to get hold of our ideas, our theories, our hypotheses, our beliefs, and then use those, mold those, shape those into ideas, concepts, things perhaps we even want to live by, but that so easily follow our own egoistic desires, as Susan B. Anthony pointed out. In other words, our own desire, our own wanting to see things according to our own way, get into that picture. Science has found a very good method to clean that out, to change that, to not allow that sort of thing to happen. Because even though you have this scientist here, a group of scientists here who have their pet idea about something or other, you have to publish it, you have to throw that out into the world, and there'll be others who are going to test that and check it out and check it out. That's why that kind of stuff doesn't go on for too long before it falls. But in the area of religion, if we don't have a method like that, and we don't, particularly if you're operating out of a belief system, we just take that on faith. It's, we say this, and then we think this is true, and that's how it is. We're going to fight it out. That I would call illogical. Because until we test and look at the foundations of what we were proposing there, there's no reason to believe it. You can't just toss something out and say, you know, that the earth sits on the back of a frog and then expect to believe it. We really should look for some evidence for that. We really should look to our experience, and we don't experience anything like that. It's just kind of a story, an idea. We can imagine such a thing, perhaps, but it doesn't make it true. It doesn't make it real. So science, you know, is a very good mechanism by which we can really keep paring out all the stuff that doesn't work. It doesn't make sense. This isn't. But in religion, to the extent that we will just hold to an idea, there's no mechanism in there to cleanse that out, to purify it, to make sure that this isn't illogical or just something we just pulled out of the air. Were we to rely on something like that, you know, just our beliefs, ideas, theories, speculations, we, at the base of our mind, the back of our minds, we are going to always be ill at ease, because somewhere in there we know what we're doing and that there isn't any basis for what we think and what we believe. This is why in Buddhism, this is precisely why in Buddhism, We have this teaching that the Tathagata, the Buddha, doesn't have any theories, doesn't form hypotheses. You'll find that in the Nikayas somewhere. I don't know where, but it's in there. But the Buddha has no theories. In the end, whatever things we do say, we get rid of them. We'll say it for a while to help us notice something, and but then we get rid of it to make sure that nobody grabs hold of that idea, that notion, saying, oh, the Buddha said this, therefore it must be true. The Buddha didn't say anything like that. So here we have this incredible teaching that doesn't allow us to get hold of anything. But because we have this strong tendency to grab hold of one thing or another, we can grab hold of the shaved head or the robes or the books or the one thing or another. We chant this chant or we do any number of things. The Buddha statues and icons and all of that. Because we're always looking for something to give us some kind of a confirmation of our own egoistic desire and tendencies to confirm ourselves somehow. And this is a very dangerous thing, particularly when we don't even have the mechanism for scouring all of that and checking out everything that we think and believe and take hold of as a theory like we'd find in science. The limit of science is that, ultimately, we actually can't get the truth into a theory, into an idea, into a concept. Though we can go, in practical terms, we can go a very long way in understanding how the world seems to operate. But we can't get to the truth that way. Religion, on the other hand, can bring us to the point where we can wake up to the truth. But we can't do that if religion gets bogged down in nonsensical, foolish, crazy ideas. The earth sits on the back of a frog or something else like that. It just says here in the book that this is so. Religion destroys itself at that point. Doesn't live up to its full potential. Because religion is about finally knowing, seeing, realizing the truth directly ourselves, which is the only way that we can. But the truth never forms as a particular idea for us. What it is that we wake up to, what it is that we realize in waking up, isn't anything in particular at all. This is why the awakened never tell us what it is that they see. Whatever it is that they would say would just become another nugget, another idea. Another thing that will be set off against you, and you've formed an ego here, and you're no longer on the mountain of egolessness. You can't eat of the fruit of the tree of enlightenment. One of the things that triggered this was not just the quote by Karen Armstrong that I first came on upon this week, but somebody put in my mailbox out here an article in the New York Times criticizing this movie, What the Bleep Do We Know? You know that one, What the Bleep? It's about applying quantum reality, quantum theory, in such a way that it matches our own egoistic desires, basically. And of course, that is a bunch of nonsense. First of all, what's laid out in that movie doesn't follow the science very well at all, in spite of the fact that ostensibly they're interviewing some scientists there, most of whom, I understand, were very chagrined and disgusted with what they saw in that movie and disappointed. But I won't get into all that now. We can discuss that if anybody really wants to. But there's another case, just one of the flaws in that movie. It's a case of how we will take something like, say, the quantum theory, which is so far out and so strange, but we will interpret that to suit our own egoistic desires, interpreting it in ways where somehow, because of this, we can shape our destinies. We can gain control of nature and the world just through our minds, things like this. These are ideas that were being brought out in that film. And all stemming from a misunderstood observation in quantum theory that somehow our very act of observing something changes it. Well, that happens to be wrong. That is not what actually occurs in quantum theory. It's not that our observing it changes things. There isn't any us. There isn't any our. There isn't any I. There isn't any ego here. There isn't any me that's actually changing anything out there in an objective reality. This is what the teaching of the awakened will point out. But the thing that I find of concern here in looking at a movie like that is that in view of the fact that we have this very strong tendency as human beings to grasp one thing or another and spin it into our own story to make it match myself, to confirm myself somehow in some way, that yes, through my consciousness, I can shape the world and change it. You know, I can control my destiny and all of this. And it's all for me, 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 me. It's me controlling that for me. And this is completely woven into, not only is it bad physics, and it does, that kind of idea doesn't match what quantum theory has actually uncovered for us. It's just bad religion. It's not only bad science, it's bad religion. We should be spending our time to realize that the world is ungraspable, something quantum theory might help us come to realize. But the fact that it is ungraspable is our liberation, is our freedom. Were we to only recognize what it is that these teachings of the awakened point out to us, to recognize your grasping mind when it operates, and to stop looking to different things that you can shape and mold to fit your own personal desires. Otherwise, we just remain caught in this bondage that we otherwise always find ourselves in. Caught up in self, caught up in ego. Desiring to know only that which I can use to make myself feel better or more free or something like that. Well, you'll never be free. You'll never be free until you recognize what you're doing there. That you are immediately throwing yourself into bondage. That there isn't any way we're going to get hold of reality. That there isn't any need for you to get hold of reality. Because whatever it is that you get hold of, that's not it. And that you that is getting hold of it isn't real either. And this is what we need to see. Were we to see this, we would experience and know and taste reality directly. And I would say that this is the function and the purpose of religion. And it is just as Karen Armstrong pointed out, it is a matter of getting past the ego. And that is it. Were we to do this, there won't be anything troubling or puzzling about the world, quantum or otherwise. Nor will you be having to hold on to one ridiculous story after another, whether it's about Noah and the flood. It's a beautiful story, actually. It tells us a lot about us human beings. I don't mean to knock it exactly. But very foolish for us today to believe literally such a story as that. But then we make up our own modern-day stories with all this quantum stuff, this quantum nonsense, quantum flapdoodle. And it's the same thing. If we understand this properly, we won't be trapped neither by stories of the ancients or the modern things that are coming at us now. We can live in real freedom of this kind of entrapment, and not only that, have actual understanding of the nature of reality and how it is. It is just that we cannot get hold of it in any way. In other words, we won't have a theory. We won't have an idea. It's another thing, science right now, they're looking for the theory of everything. These TOE theories are called, T-O-E, theory of everything. Yeah. And they got a little formula there that... That won't be it. If you look at this carefully, that won't be it. You can't get a theory of everything. But you can see everything. Or you can do something that is the equivalent of seeing everything. And that is called awakening. And this, I think, is the real purpose of religion, and not to drag us into all kinds of foolishness of our grasping mind. You know, because our religions are formed out of that. Everything that we do is formed out of that, really. At least in science, we test it. But what religion is about is leaving all of that aside and learning to see directly what your experience is. And that leaves us free of all of this stuff. Well, I got a lot more to say about what goes on in that movie, however, but just the actual physics alone is faulty. Yeah. But we'll save that for another time, if it's necessary. Yeah, Mike.
Someone asked the Dalai Lama, I think it's been in the past year, they said, what if the teachings of neuroscience contradicted the teachings of Buddhism? What then? And he said, well, then Buddhism would have to change its teachings.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is what we have to understand this about Buddhism. That whatever, first of all, Buddhism doesn't really teach in that way, though, however, you know. In other words, the teaching of the awakened won't offer us a theory of neuroscience or whatever. So Buddhism's never really holding anything out there. So I'm not too sure how threatened Buddhism would be, you know, in that way. Science cannot find something that will cause one who follows the Buddha way to quake in their boots or to be upset. They just won't find anything. Whatever you find, you know, if it can hold up to the scrutiny that everything is put through in the area of science, it would be celebrated and appreciated. Oh, one more little detail here we can understand. But it isn't going to do anything to tear it down. That's why, like, a theory of evolution or the theory of the heliocentric solar system, any of these kinds of things, aren't threats to Buddhism. I would say if you follow a religious way that can be threatened in these ways, you better look at that very seriously. Something's wrong there. Because as my friend or co-worker would argue, how illogical evolution is, well, I would say it's not illogical. At least it's based on very sound observation. And it's been supported in all kinds of places, geologically, cosmologically, of course biologically, genetically, astronomically, I mean in all kinds of ways it's supported. And as more and more things are found out about the world, it just keeps fitting. It's a sound, pretty sound theory. Yeah. Does it finally get us to that last nugget of truth? No, it can't. That's not its purpose, I don't think. But to just pull something out of the air and then to believe it, this is very dangerous. And I want us to understand here that in Buddhism, as I understand it and as I teach it, we're not doing that. And I think we can find support for that all the way back, going back to the earliest text, like in the Nikayas, where it says that the Tathagata has no theories. Because the moment you put something into a theory, into a graspable form, into an idea, into a statement, we say right up front that this is not truth. Truth doesn't do that. You can't do that with truth. We do need our ideas, we do need our theories, our concepts, beliefs, okay. But let's at least get them kind of organized and rational and have them, to some degree, match our actual experience and hold them loosely and allow them to change and to switch. And if some new evidence comes to light, this seems to be pretty sound, well, that's fine, great, let's take it in. This is very important to understand. Otherwise, we will be rattled by all of this. You know, I remember one time going up to appear, I spoke with a group of skeptics, and there's one all evening, it was a small group in a living room, but they all gathered there to put me under attack, you know. And this one guy kept bringing up evolution. He didn't know that I was a biologist earlier in my life. And I love the theory of evolution. I understand it quite well. And I've studied it in all different ways, and in different ways it could be applied in that. But he was attacking me as if I were a born-again Christian and somehow had a problem with Darwin and the theory of evolution and that sort of thing. And what I was trying to get across, but it was very difficult, because Buddhism's a religion, you know. very difficult to get across that, you know, there isn't anything there that science will lay out here that will be troubling for me. And I would say only in this way, then, if people argue, well, is religion and science, aren't they at odds with each other? Well, yeah, as long as religion keeps hanging on to belief. And, of course, we think religion and belief is one and the same thing. I mean, that's, you know, belief doesn't function very well there at all. It functions quite well in the area of science because it's so well tested and honed and everything. But even there, it's limited. But it doesn't work here at all in religion. So let's drop it. I'm writing a book on this, by the way. I hope you read it, but maybe I've scared you off with this talk this morning. But it doesn't function there at all. And we use our beliefs, our religious beliefs, to, well, look at the world today. We are going to wipe ourselves out as a species if we don't knock this kind of stuff off. No, religion should function in such a way that it is compatible with science and that science cannot assail it or tear it down. Religion can finally help us to fulfill that last aspect. It's a very, covers kind of a small area in a sense, but it underlies everything. But religion can function in such a way that it takes us to that point that where science can't bring us, and that is to finally wake up to actual reality, which we can do, provided we don't hang on to a bunch of ideas, or any ideas. Yeah, man.
When people use faith, maybe more so these days, I don't know, in the past, but use faith as a sort of a buffer or protection against logic and reason.
Mm-hmm.
So, just so they can hold their...
Yeah.
And that's why you hear a lot. You just have to believe. You just have to have faith.
Yeah, that's another thing. You see, we equate belief and faith. That we put our faith, our trust, in our belief. We put our faith... For most of us, faith and belief are interchangeable because we're so used to looking at it that way. This really reveals how conceptual we are, what conceptual animals we are, that we don't even realize that we're doing this, that we put our trust, our faith in our thinking, in what we believe. That's what we trust. That's what we put our confidence in. Yeah. But in Buddhism, we don't put our confidence, our trust, our faith in what we think. We ultimately set aside what we think. As Wang Po said, the enlightened or the wise, he said that they reject what they think, not what they see. The foolish reject what they see, not what they think. So we do just the reverse. So we put our trust, our faith in our experience, our direct experience, our wordless direct experience. Wordless because they can't be put into words, but we nevertheless can directly see reality and understand it. That's enlightenment. We put our faith, our trust in that. Not in our thinking, not in our stories, not in our teachings. This is why the Buddha likened his teaching to the raft. Or who was it? Some other Zen master said he likened the teachings to kind of a blanket that you would throw around you when you're sick. You need a blanket. You've got the chills, whatever. So you throw a blanket around you when you're sick. Okay? And our sickness is kind of our ignorance, our confusion, you know. But once you're well, we let go of the blanket. And it's just like the teaching of the raft, that the teaching of the awakened is like a raft or like that blanket. It serves a function. It will help us when we're ill, when we're sick, when we need to get across the river, whatever, however the metaphor is being used. But then in the end, when we wake up to what is taking, we don't need it. That's... Okay, there's where all the words are taking place. And we set that aside. We let that go. That's our thinking. And we don't put our faith, our trust in that. We might trust it to help us in some way, but we don't end up trusting or believing or thinking that somehow this has something to do with truth. Or that words can be used in a way to actually state the truth. Yeah. So this is very important for us to understand. These are subtle points I'm bringing out here this morning. I hope I made them clear. But these are extremely important. Because without clarifying some of these issues, we're just going to be caught up in a cobweb of confusion, sticky confusion, and not steer our way out. I know that this teaching, when understood properly and carried out properly, will clear it all up. But what I also see is how easily we get caught by one thing or another or another or another. And this is what we need to learn, to see for ourselves. I can't see any of this for you. I'll try to help you notice where we get stuck and caught. But for each one of us, you have to see this yourself and learn how not to get entangled in these ways. Was there something over here? Were you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's because I'd like to know what means, if it's really that way, if it's really that way that we should overcome the ego, and perhaps just to, I'd like that if you could make that a bit more clear, because just to clarify what I mean, what I understand. For example, I think we need to use the ego somehow to have relationship to, even if you are in a very high level approach of life, let's say living as a monk in a monastery, you need to have a relationship. So you need to laugh, you need to be serious sometimes.
Yeah.
And this could be part of the ego. Actually, I think it is the system that we are, you know. So to what extent should we really overcome the ego? Because you said in the beginning that religion usually puts this, that we should, you know, go beyond ego.
Mm-hmm.
But I myself have tried to do that in the past.
Oh, but you can't.
But yeah. I couldn't.
Yeah, you can't do that. So don't try.
Actually, I realized that I was denying lots of good things that I could use, you know.
Yeah, yeah. You can't use your ego to get rid of the ego, so to speak. And besides, we can't get rid of it. You're quite right. But this is about learning to see through that. To the extent that we take up ideas, concepts, we use them, the ego has now entered into that picture, and it works, yes. And we never really talk about getting rid of this. That's called going to an extreme. We live in this world of muddy water. We will appear here as a separate self and an ego. But what we are talking about is realizing the nature of that and not getting caught by that and not letting that ego or the egoistic desires be the driver, what's driving all of this. Rather, our desire is on awakening, on seeing out of wholeness and totality rather than out of the little self. It is quite possible to live in such a way where you don't have to consult your own personal egoistic desires about everything. And in fact, we can live in such a way that you rarely have to at all. Nevertheless, the fact that we appear in the world as a separate individual, and that we don't deny, we don't throw that away. To that extent, ego is there, yeah. And so we have to learn to live it. But to get past that, as Karen Armstrong was saying, I think, is to not let that run everything all the time. For most of us, that's what's in the driver's seat, me, I. It's all about me and how I can arrange it for myself. It is possible to live free of that. You're taking what I'm saying to throw it to an extreme, and we can't really do that. But we don't have to live with that in the driver's seat, so to speak. I don't know, did that make it clear there?
Yeah. Can I pose?
Sure. Yeah.
It's because we have this individual lives. For example, I think my life is unique. Nobody has my history, mm-hmm. only me.
Yeah.
And so, on the other hand, you get science and religion posing theories to us that could, take as much people as possible in that category, in that approach. So that's why up to today, I'm 40 years old now, I didn't get involved eternally with a particular religion,
mm-hmm.
you know. But I think that we have this, you know, this thing which is unique to us, you know, this history. So. How could I stay, for example, in Buddhism if I don't want to become part of a system? You know, although you say, and Buddhism usually says that Buddhism is not a religion, you know. But you
no,
have
I don't,
some,
no, I don't think not, I say that. I say it's not a belief system.
Yeah, right.
I wouldn't say it's not a religion.
It's not a belief system.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. So, but actually, you have this. You have three things in Buddhism, which is Buddha, Dharma, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. the Sangha. I can understand that we can stay together as a Buddhist group for the Sangha reason mm-hmm. and for the just to get the superior connection. Also, could explain that. But for the Dharma reason, I don't see why. Because we can follow the Dharma if we are alone.
Well, you're never alone.
Yes.
We're always together. You know, we're always interacting with others. And for people who are interested in realizing the truth directly, it is helpful for us to come together and to discuss this and to talk about this. It's quite natural, you know, that we would collect into little groups here and there. But these can shift and change over time, and they do. So it's very dynamic. But as these gatherings form, that's called Sangha. Yeah, and then the Dharma, that's which we would put our mind to. To look, to see, that's reality, to wake up to that. Or the teaching, what the awakened say, that would be the words coming from the Buddha, or a Buddha. So all of that is there, and it's all very fluid. And you said something about, you know, wishing to join a Buddhist group or following the Buddhist way or whatever. Yeah, well, that's fine, but I would say just drop that idea and... rather than thinking about, well, I'm going to join a group or follow a group or a particular way or something like that. I mean, you may do these things, and that's fine. But more important to just put your mind on that you want to follow this way of awakening. And I think that if you did, you're very likely to end up associating in a group like this than not. But there's no hard and fast rule for it. Nor do we need to take on some identity that, oh, I am a Buddhist. You know, something like that. I never think of myself that way. Ever. You know, I mean, I show up here and I do this, but I don't think about it. I just do it. So I don't have to walk around with some identity. Oh, I'm a Buddhist teacher, or I'm this, I'm that. You know, that's not necessary for us to do that. And then I think we can really follow this way. If we drop all that, then we actually are following the way of awakening and the way of the Buddhas. But to the extent that we will say, oh, I am a Buddha, we'll take on an identity. You know, it's bad enough I slap on this robe. I keep looking at this all the time. I'm not too sure about this, you know. But we'll just keep looking at it.
Like I'm hard to put this sort of ideas, but it's because I have this problem with myself. I was born as a rebel, and I'm always against everything, actually.
Yeah. Well, you know,
actually, you should know a little bit of my history to understand.
Yeah.
I have no father, I have no mother, in a sense. So probably this is the reason why I'm not attached to, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's one thing to be just non-attached, and maybe to not latch on to things and to hold tightly to things. That's one thing. That's one extreme. And the other extreme would be to throw them away, to push them away, or to denounce them, or to put them down, or whatever, to shut them out. That's not necessary either. That's the other extreme. And this way of awakening is just simply to avoid these. Both to just rebel for no reason, or even just to rebel, or to put down, or to grasp and to hang on, you know. And I've said things about different ways and practices and beliefs and things, but I don't mean to put any of it down as though it were bad or wrong or evil or whatever. I don't even really care about that, or it's foolish or stupid to follow this. But just point it out for what it is. If you hold a particular belief, say you believe literally in the Noah and the flood, it's kind of irrational for us today. But that's not quite the same as it's a saying that those who might hold that notion or whatever are bad or evil or wrong or going to hell or whatever. Let's just bring this in and we can discuss any of this stuff. Bring it into this field where it's all very fluid. And if we ourselves are not holding on to any one notion or nugget or idea. We neither have to embrace it or endorse it or to denounce it. You know, but just try to point it out for how it appears. This appears to be irrational. If you think maybe not, well, then let's discuss that. How is it not irrational? See? Be open for that discussion. Yeah.
It strikes me that to believe is to write out front to concede not knowing.
To believe is to concede not knowing?
Yes.
Yeah, how so? I think you might be onto something there.
If you know something, you couldn't possibly say that I believe. You would say I know.
Yeah.
I think the problem with religion is to assert any form of not knowing as knowing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Believe. Right. Right. Basically what it is that we don't know is the idea, the concept. It's precisely the opposite of what we think. We think that, you know, if I hold an opinion, an idea, a concept, a belief, then we confuse that with knowledge. But what I will say, and what the teaching of the Awakened will say, is that the very fact that something is formed in your mind as a concept, as an idea, a belief, or an object of some sort, that is not known. That is precisely just that. It is thought, it is believed, it is conceptualized. What is known never forms as an object. So in that way, you're quite right. So knowledge is something different from belief, you know? But even in a more subtle way than you were pointing out. Though what you pointed out was quite valid. Yeah.
Knowledge with a capital K.
Yeah. That's not knowledge of a particular thing. That's just relative. Under relative circumstance, maybe we can say this is so. Okay. Ultimately, not the case at all. And that can be demonstrated. But I won't have time this morning to do that. Actually, it's probably gone a little late. David?
At the beginning of your talk, you pointed out how irrational it is to want egolessness. But many times, and in fact, today you said later on, you said the awakened want to be awake. Mm-hmm. Or that should be our only desire, to want to be awake. Can you speak a little bit to the difference between wanting egolessness and wanting to be awake?
Yeah, there's a number of things that could be said there, but wanting, interesting point. Wanting egolessness is, you're wanting a thing, you're wanting a formed thing, the idea of egolessness. Whereas wanting to be awake, this is the simplest way to answer it, so I'll just give this quickly, but because there's a lot of things that could be said here now. But wanting to be awake is, to truly want to be awake, that's what we're talking about, is to not to want some particular thing. It is to realize that, in other words, you don't really have something formed in your mind. Now, most of us do want, we say, well, I want to be enlightened, and we have formed some kind of idea about what that is. That's why we don't wake up, because we're grasping at something that we're already holding. It's already our confusion, and we're holding tightly to it and not realizing what the problem is here. So wanting to be awake, as the awakened want to be awake in the next moment, they're not confused by this. What it is that they're aware of is the nature of delusion, the nature of holding and grasping, and that's kind of related to what you were saying there. And then just simply that, then they don't have to get caught up in it. It doesn't mean that it goes away. Enlightenment only can occur in the world of delusion. So it isn't like we have enlightenment and now delusion is all gone. No, delusion and enlightenment are here in the same place together at once. But one who is awake to that and realizes that, they're not holding to an idea about awakeness, or their notion of wanting to be awake in the next moment isn't a grasping of any particularness. Whereas wanting to be free of the ego is. So it's quite different in that way. There's other factors I could bring out about this as well, but I think that's probably the simplest and most direct one. I don't know, did that make sense? Did you follow me on that? Yeah. Okay. Well, it is almost 11 o'clock now, so maybe we should end it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.